There, do you have any idea what you're listening to?
London Philharmonic?
It's Venus.
Uh-huh.
Venus.
Why not? We bounced signals off the moon's surface. There's no reason that Venus shouldn't radiate impulses.
I don't mean the static. Can't you hear it, the other thing?
What other thing?
Listen to it, Paul. Listen to the voice.
Hello and welcome to Media Geek. This is your weekly look at the world of grassroots and independent media, as well as a critical examination of our media environment. My name is Paul Rees-Mandel, and I'm your host. On today's program, bringing community radio to Latin America. In the studio with me are folks from Radios Populares, a Chicago-based group trying to bring non-commercial community radio to Latin America, as I said. You do want to stay tuned. All right, you're not hearing me in the headphones, huh? Fantastic. Well, I guess you'll hear me in the studio at the very least. Hey, we'll figure this out. Eventually, I know we sent out something for a repair. Well,
it's no worries.
In the studio with me is Alan Gomez and Lisa Matuska. Thank you very much for joining me here from Radios Populares.
Welcome. Thank you.
Thanks.
I gave the 10-second summary at the beginning of the program. Maybe you'd like to tell me a little bit more about the history of the group and your mission, Alan.
Sure. Radios Populares has been around since, originally, I guess, 2002. And it was formed out of Latin American solidarity work. So the nature of Radios Populares was really about how to connect with communities in Latin America to be able to provide solidarity or some sort of aid in some sort of progressive struggle for social justice, economic justice, other types of struggles going on in countries throughout Latin America. In the course of doing events and providing some sort of support work for other groups that were doing solidarity work, the question of can anyone help us get a small radio station up and running came up. And with some of the background that some of us had, we said, well, it's pretty accessible. It's, you know, technology is accessible, the costs, you know, compared to other types of things. And also we consider it what would be dubbed an appropriate technology. Everyone has radios, you know, it's not like the internet where everyone would have to go get a computer or you'd have to set up some sort of internet connectivity. And also it stems outward from a local source, which is also really important for the organizing capacity of the groups that we end up working with. Literacy and distribution isn't a problem with radio. And so it fit all those ideals. And we started working initially with a group called La Voz de los de Abajo, the voice of those below. And they were doing work in Honduras with landless farmers who they organize farmers, campesinos, and do land takeovers of unused lands or lands that are up for agrarian reform. And they said, well, once we organize 100 families and do a land takeover, you know, everyone kind of like starts working on the land, it'd be great to have a radio station as basically the key form of communication between everyone. And so we got a small transmitter together and trained folks on how to set it up and how to keep from frying it out. Mm-hmm. Very rudimentary trainings. And that's basically how Radios Populares started.
Okay. So this particular group you mentioned work in agrarian reform, essentially, mm-hmm. Campesinos. What other types of groups do you work with?
Well, throughout the different countries that we've worked with, which have included Mexico, Honduras, Nicaragua, Ecuador, and Bolivia, each group has had its own particular type of struggle. The agrarian reform in Honduras, in Nicaragua is a women's cooperative, and in Mexico is Zapotec youth that were trying to promote campaigns against Plan Puebla Panama and other neoliberal agendas. And Ecuador is another indigenous organization in the community of Salasaca that had set up their own Montessori based but indigenous school that would be in their own language, and they wanted to maintain their identity during times when Spanish has become very dominant there instead of Quechua. And our most recent project was Bolivia. Lisa could talk about
it. In Bolivia, it was a youth performance sort of organization that had really grown in the last couple of years. And so they had already been doing a lot of audio, a lot of theater projects, and their theater focused around empowering youth, social issues in this sort of very indigenous area and also a poor area around La Paz. And so the idea that the youth were creating a lot of theater that's focused around these social issues, and so they wanted an outlet to kind of get their message a little farther, put their art out there. And they also had ideas for sort of bilingual programming, so promoting the Aymara language, which was important there. And that's what we did in November. So that was most
okay. So recent. Most recently, and so when you say you bring stations, you bring equipment down,
yeah,
and then provide, as you mentioned, training on how to set it up, how to keep it running. Is there any interface with the radio authorities?
Well, we don't have any type of interface with the radio authorities or the governing bodies. The relationship that we have with the communities is really based on kind of like mutual, mutualism. Therefore, we don't want to develop any kind of paternalistic relationship. Mm-hmm. We can't answer some questions for them. We can just present, like, just from our experience, some of the questions, including that of like to get a license or to not get a license. They'll know the conditions on the ground more so as to, like, depending on their organizing capacity, there are other types of resources that they may have on whether they want to pursue that route or not. Our premise is that if we choose to work with them, we choose to work with them whether or not they pursue that route. In Nicaragua, they did have the resources and also capacity to be able to organize to get their frequency, and it's in the community that we set it up, Mulukuku. They've already bumped up to like 300 watts. They're probably the most listened to station for maybe about a 40-mile radius. They're doing like amazing things with it, and they've got their own frequency, their own license. In other communities, say going back to Honduras, for instance, they're not pursuing a license. It's incredibly expensive and virtually unattainable. And so the way that they're using it is still more as like a rural organizing communication tool.
Are these primarily AM stations, FM stations?
We solely work with FM. Mm-hmm. The size of the equipment is just, it's transportable, mm-hmm. The antennas and everything. And just from our experiences, FM is what we've stuck with.
And is it true in most of the countries that you've worked in thus far that the media environment looks a lot like the U.S. in that it's dominated by commercial powers or by the dominant political forces, and therefore tends to have few indigenous or minority voices in it, or at least unfiltered?
Right, and I think that's that would be present in any kind of situation where there's an oligarchy that kind of dominates. Of course, it wants to hear itself more so than any other voices that might be critical of it. In some instances, however, it's not even so much that they're deliberately blocking out the access. There just isn't the mm-hmm. infrastructure there in place. Mulukuku, going back to Nicaragua, is kind of a prime example because it was a rural community. Power's only on like 10 hours, was back then only on 10 hours a day. The only other radio station in the area, in the town, was a evangelical radio station that would denounce the women of the cooperative as witches and kind of was holding on to some very antiquated views. So there definitely was. They weren't a government institution. They weren't that station was not even, I dare say, not even like really part of the oligarchy or the large mainstream. But they still were shunning the progressive work that was being done.
Is there a sense of at all the overbearing Americanization and paternalism in a lot of other development which is offered? in these communities?
Yeah, I mean, I think in Bolivia it was we got strong stories when we went there about this particular place we were working, because it had been the place where a lot of mobilization happened over privatization of the gas and the water in the country, especially in 2003 in El Alto. It's an area where there's a lot of youth coming in from the rural areas to find work, mostly indigenous. So this was the area where the uprisings had happened, and a lot the sort of neoliberal president at that point, who was ousted right after that following many, many unsuccessful presidential successors. But it was interesting how they had mobilized. All of it was from very grassroots levels, all of this mobilization, just blocking the roads to make sure that so nothing gets in La Paz, so the people in La Paz are aware that there is people in this city in El Alto that surrounds La Paz trying to stop this privatization. So I think that was a huge, huge theme in a lot of the work that Teatro Trono did and in other areas, I'm sure.
And in the U.S. and now to some extent in Europe and certainly in Canada, and there's been a pretty well-developed idea of community radio. It isn't always powerful, but it exists in a lot of communities. In you know, whether it's a strict community station, hybrid models, college stations which provide access, and you know, it sort of falls into very similar approaches. There's, you know, usually some progressive or public affairs talk programming, some national talk programming, along with a lot of music programming that you know, one hopes reflects the community. Do these stations that you're seeing come up, that you're helping to put on the air, reflect the similar sort of programming approach, or do they serve a little different purpose than maybe we're used to here in the post-industrial world?
Well, definitely the context in which the stations are born, I think, is determines at the very least the structure that they set up for how they're going to use the radio station. Some things are very particular that in regards to what language they're going to be providing programming in. Obviously, in Salasaca, it's predominantly all in Quechua, which serves as a very powerful tool for the Quechua speaking community to recognize the agency in their mm-hmm. own language and culture. In other areas that are a little more urban, they may replicate a slight, maybe something a little closer to that U.S. model. But in the more rural settings, where there are no cell phones, there are no there's no internet access, none of those things, you really do see the radio serving as kind of like a primary source of communication to reach people who can't be reached except by 2 days on horseback or something like that.
Mm-hmm. So that communication function becomes a bit more of a backbone then, in a way which we don't tend to rely as much on radio these days in the U.S.
Right, unless there's some sort of national emergency. You don't see that here all too often. But definitely there, particularly around education or just to keep going back to Nicaragua, because I think it's one of those prime examples of how the radio is being used beyond what we've come to consider it here. They have a health clinic, and some other stuff that they present on the radio is educational programming that's geared towards having people come into the clinic, and it's a women and children's clinic, and so for prenatal care and other types of things, as well as educating the population on domestic violence and the rights, mm-hmm. you know, of women and children. Like I was saying before, that cooperative is pretty progressive by some of the standards there. And when they first built the women and children's clinic, it was loved by everyone because the health issue, no one would argue against. When they started addressing domestic violence, mm-hmm. all of a sudden, not everyone really cared for them. So it was really important to get these messages out and be able to kind of like introduce them both to communicate to people that here is an option, here is a resource, but also to kind of like set the parameters of discussion around like that. Let's not pretend there's anything right or that natural about a domestic violence situation, for instance.
And listeners already in these areas, especially rural areas, I mean, would they already be accustomed to listening to the radio?
Absolutely. Latin America, and I'm sure many other pre-post-industrial. many other countries in the global south have had long history of mm-hmm. radio as being both a very radicalizing tool and a very functional tool for communication, you know, in many different historical moments. Mm-hmm. And so that once again just goes back to how radio in Latin America is what we consider an appropriate technology.
And given its potential and power, as it's sometimes used, does it become a threat to any of these organizations or these communities from the standpoint of the official government or other parallel groups' view of it? Do they see it as a threat?
I think definitely. And once again, the context also dictates how much of a threat or how much threatening response there is to the emergence of these low power stations. In Honduras, the community that we work with is they're called the CNTC. It's more the organization, I should say, rather, because they operate in a variety of different communities around the entire country. When they started their radio station, it became very popular right away because they were speaking to a lot of the realities that get neglected in other mainstream or the equivalent forms of communication. And there's definitely, they had given out a phone number, the cell phone number, and in that community there's cell phone access. But I think one of the, I remember hearing some stories even recently of death threats being called in, you know, and things like that, which obviously considering the nature of the work that they're doing and even historical violence against the CNTC with targeted assassinations, you know, all of those have to be taken very seriously.
Mm-hmm. But given that, I mean, I guess these organizations or communities, I mean, did they come to you or did you get sort of meet up through various social connections or not really social connections, but connections between groups? How does the linking up come to bear?
Well, I think that Alan touched upon this, but it's kind of based through this sort of Latin American solidarity that a lot of us have had connections with different groups. I think a lot of their earlier projects were just from different solidarity projects they had been working with previously who recognized this tool of radio as something that could be very helpful. And the way, this is going off a little bit different, but the way we raise money is all grassroots fundraising. So a lot of the groups, for example, the group we just worked with in Bolivia, they had been up here in Chicago with some of their troop members doing some performances for another fundraiser for the Nicaragua, I believe.
Right. Mm-hmm.
So they kind of saw the work through that sense, and they said, well, maybe this radio, having radio station would be something good for us. So I think that, I don't think it's very natural to come down to a place and say, here, we have this radio station, mm-hmm. like, drop it on them and see what they do. And I think that also has to do with a little bit the way they structure their station. We don't ever go down and say, well, this is how a radio station should look like. Like, here's your, you know, hour of news. Here's your Amy Goodman. Here's your blah, blah, blah. Mm-hmm. I think that it's a hard process, and we saw it in Bolivia, but they have to think about what is going to be good for their community, what is going to be good, what personnel they have to work with. Are they going to have volunteers? Are they going to want to sustain a larger, grander station? And in which case, sometimes they have upgraded transmitters to get more power. But, yeah, it's definitely not so much a network between, I think, yet that has formed, but projects that are definitely connected in some other ways besides this.
And for all the stations that we've worked with, there's definitely been the idea has been sparked from the communities themselves. They've identified it. And then for us, it's like that we're offering solidarity and it just happens to be mm-hmm. radio.
So it's fair to say you're not a radio group looking for organizations, communities, countries that need radio stations.
Right. Yeah, that's actually very accurate. You know, we often say we don't do radio for radio's sake. I mean, considering that it is all volunteer, it is all grassroots fundraising, we wouldn't have the capacity to fill because everyone from here to Tanzania, it's like, I got a great idea for a radio program. And they may However, the way that we look at it is that because we have a limited amount of time, resources, and other things to offer, that the relationship can be developed more very specifically around a solidarity model towards like some sort of progressive change, progressive struggle.
And I think it's accurate to say that it takes about a year and change for for these the funds to get raised, for the equipment to get purchased, and for schedules to work out to go down there and carry out these projects. So if people, groups have the patience to wait around for that, then it's obviously something that they have been looking and planning at the same time.
And so they will do their own fundraising and planning and organizing back at home.
Right. It's definitely a mutual, you know, mutually inclusive process in that way, because we want to make sure that when we start the dialogue with the community, that they know exactly who they're getting involved with and what our limitations are. And to some degree, we're really happy that there are limitations, because that puts the onus on us then to connect with our communities here for the fundraising, for the actually expanding our communities here, their knowledge about what type of struggle, what it looks like, who it is, what they're doing, and that there's this tangible goal to help augment that struggle with our making that connection with our communities here. And in some cases, there's been really amazing outcomes that have developed linkages that have developed with members of the community here, with the communities in Latin America that we've worked with. At the same time, also, I think even if they have been receiving funds or support from large, you know, intergovernmental or agencies or Oxfam or the EU or other types of, you know, development groups, they recognize that that's kind of a paternalistic relationship. And then with us, they know that, you know, we're scraping every dollar out of, you know, out of wherever we can, and that it is just an act of solidarity. And not that we have a bag of funds or some sort of grant that says, oh, you have to go find some community to work with and set it up. Or inversely, that if we were to get some sort of grant funding that would say, you can't work with this community because of X, Y, or Z. So that's I think that having that type of relationship with the communities is really important to us.
And yet, I think it's pretty foreign to the model that most people have in their minds. Of international, you know, what would, I guess, normally gets called development work, really. I mean, if you're, whether it's UNESCO or another NGO that works out there, your model obviously comes from previous struggles, previous solidarity work. I mean, it's hard to use any other word. You know, is there anything, any recent sort of work that led kind of to Radios Populares?
Well, I think, like we were talking about, the work that the solidarity group La Voz de los Abajo was doing in Honduras, there's obviously a direct correlation there. I think a good number of us involved in the group, not that there's a good number of people involved in the group, some of us had been doing anti-FTAA work.
Free Trade Area of the Americas.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. We had been supporting, organizing in different countries around that. And so I think seeing that and some of the experiences that some members of our organization have had, and both in Chiapas and with Zapatista communities in Ecuador, Free Trade Area of the Americas protests, Miami as well and stuff, and making those kinds of connections and linkages between what we can do here to help augment the type of resistance or struggles to, like, whether it's that or others, and as we've discovered, it's more than just one kind of brand of struggle. We figure what we can do here, and that's kind of where this has been developed from.
And when you talk about here in Chicago,
in the states, stateside, but obviously we are here in Chicago. We're based out of here. And one of the things that we've actually have refocused on is what kind of work can we do here for communities here in Chicago. And what we've identified is that none of us are engineers. None of us have, like, you know, 30 years of experience, you know.
Speak for yourself.
Lisa, engineer, Matuska. She's a train engineer.
No.
But none of us are, you know, we haven't studied it. We haven't, you know, we've learned by doing as well as by meeting up with other groups that do similar type of tech work and working together, such as Bill Taylor's Primary Communications Project down in outside Champaign, and also the Prometheus Radio Project based out of Philadelphia. And they've both been wonderful assets to help augment our abilities and answer a lot of questions for us. But our premise is, if we could figure it out, then anyone should be able to do it as well. And so we want to bring that, we try to bring that to the communities we work with in Latin America. But now we also want to expand that type of knowledge and sense of access, pull back the screen of inaccessibility to the communities here in Chicago. Mm-hmm. And what we've been doing is organizing, we call them Making Waves workshops, just kind of an introduction, a primer to what it takes to set up a low power radio station.
a micro power, maybe.
Micro power, exactly. Yes. You know, and also just kind of like having people experiment for themselves on what they would say, what they would like to hear, what kind of programming would really speak to, you know, both their desires and interests and needs.
Mm-hmm. And you have such an event coming up.
We do.
Yep.
Funny you should ask.
It's not this weekend, but next weekend on the 21st. We're gonna have a Making Waves workshop. Some like to call them Mau Wau Wos. It's a little.
We've developed our own language.
And it's going to be at the Mess Hall, which is in Rogers Park on Glenwood, I believe.
6932 North Glenwood Avenue.
Mm-hmm. Conveniently.
In Rogers Park, which is in Chicago.
Yes, which is a north neighborhood in Chicago. And we've actually had another workshop there about a year ago, I think. Similar workshops where we set out all the equipment, all the studio equipment necessary, actually the transmitting equipment, the antenna stuff. This year, we're going to also try to have some recording and editing equipment. So, you know, just how easy it is to take a little recording microphone, put it on the computer, edit your sound, whatever. Hopefully people will produce some stuff. It's going to be like 5 hours or 4 hours. So in that time,
we'll
throw some food to the masses.
But to get an opportunity to try out all these different technologies and maybe demystify it and show really simple this stuff is.
Pulling the veil back. And I think that that's exactly kind of, although it's almost impossible, you know, to just get a license here or just, you know, broadcast for very long. I think that unlike the stations in Latin America, where whether they have a license or not, they're doing this out of this need. There is kind of a need for people to be able to say what they want to hear on the media. There shouldn't be this sort of mass media that we just consume all our media from. So maybe pulling the veil back can rile some people up a little bit.
Mm-hmm. Sounds great. I'd love to sit here and talk for another hour. but you all have things to do, and we have another show waiting in the wings. So, Alan Gomez, Lisa Matuska from Radios Populares, radiospopulares.org is your website. And you'll be at the Mess Hall in Chicago, 6932 North Glenwood Avenue on Sunday, June 21st, beginning at noon. It's in the Rogers Park neighborhood here in Chicago. Thank you so much for coming.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
And that brings to a close another edition of Media Geek. I'll be back in one more week with more news and views on our media environment. My guest will be Jerry Del Cagliano. He's a man who brings you InsideMusicMedia.com. He is a longtime radio industry insider. He saw the fall of commercial radio before it came. He predicted it. And now he's got some very interesting knowledge to lay on all of you about what he sees in the future of radio. You will want to tune in for that in one more week. And, of course, the Media Geek website is at MediaGeek.net. And to hear some of the programs with some of the guests who you heard about today, like Jill Freeberg and Bill Taylor, they're all there on the Radio Media Geek website, radio.mediageek.net. Send any comments to me, paul@mediageek.net, or twitter.com/MediaGeek. Thanks for tuning in.